Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast After Dark, the after show for the Filmcast, where we talk about a variety of random topics that did not make it into the show. I'm David Chen. I'm joined by Jeff Kanata, Devinder Hardawar. Today, we got a couple of news items.
Thank you!
Didn't even leave any room for it. Wow.
I was gonna prompt you, Jeff. I was gonna prompt you, but you stepped.
I felt like you were moving on.
I would never. We still live in a COVID bubble with our friend Carter, and she has this saying. She says a lot. I would never a lot. You know, so I've adopted it into my. Anyway, this episode of the After Dark brought to you courtesy of the fine folks at Patreon.com/filmpodcast.
Thank you.
It's a little underwhelming now that you did it.
Yeah. He used it all. Already.
I used it all up.
Yeah.
I'll just say a quick comment about that, which is that the support of our listeners is more invaluable than ever these days.
Agreed.
As we head into a very challenging economic environment. We are extremely grateful to people who continue to support the podcast. So if you're doing that, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And if you're sharing a password with someone, consider getting your own account. That's what I have to say. But anyway, today on The After Dark, we want to remember a few people that have passed over the last couple weeks and then dive into an in-depth review of Barry Season 3, which just finished on HBO. So let's get into it. There are a couple people passed away. One of them this week, actually. Philip Baker Hall passed away this week.
Yeah.
I remember listening to the director's commentary on the Paul Thomas Anderson film Magnolia. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And him saying, I think Philip Baker Hall is the best living American actor. and that's why he's tried to include Philip Baker Hall in virtually every single one of his films. This guy, I generally thought of as a character actor, but he obviously brought a lot of gravitas to everything he did. In his later years, I really appreciated him seemingly to me, like maybe he always did this, but for my perception, it seemed like he was cutting loose a little bit more, doing more comedic roles. Uh-huh. For instance, playing Hank Hippopopoulos in BoJack Horseman. He was in the television show Corporate, which is very funny, and a few things of that nature. But I always loved this guy.
He was so good in Corporate too, because it's like it is like the lunch introduction, right? And he is yeah, it's just like funny. It's like the alter ego team to the core corporate team. Mm-hmm. And he's just a complete heel. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. But I would agree. He's an amazing actor. He leaves behind an incredible body of work. He's been in some of the greatest films of all time. You know.
Yeah. If there's a chance that you have not seen Hard Eight, mm-hmm. out there, mm-hmm. listeners, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's first movie.
Did you like that? Because I actually have never seen it.
You've never seen it?
I've never seen it because I heard Paul Thomas Anderson had such a I don't know that he really loves that film because he had such a terrible time making it.
It's worth watching,
dude. It's I haven't seen it since the 90s, but it made a big impression on me.
Oh wow, okay. I didn't know this. All right,
yeah,
I'll try to check it out.
It was kind of him doing Tarantino stuff, you know, like when everybody was. So I think that's why he didn't feel it was as creatively fulfilling. Yeah.
Well, I think also the process of making it, like it, mm-hmm. you know, my understanding from what I vaguely can recall is that
he would have been
a lot of conflicting creative forces. Like he wanted to do it one way. He obviously has a very strong perspective on how his movie should be made, and mm-hmm. I think the investors or the studios or whatever behind it weren't aligned.
He would have been like 26.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine like trying to get your way when you're spending millions of other people's money at 26. It's just it must have been difficult. But Hard Eight, Magnolia, Boogie Nights, the Insider, you know, Zodiac, right? I mean, he's been in just a ton of amazing films. Do you guys have any like things specifically that you, when you think of Philip Baker Hall, is there a specific movie or performance you think of?
I mean, Hard Eight, Magnolia. I think of the Paul Thomas Anderson films. He's so, you know, he's so tied to that filmmaker clearly. And I also remember him from Seinfeld. Remember him in Seinfeld?
Yeah.
I think Joe Bookman he's credited as Lieutenant Joe Bookman.
Yeah.
Whenever it's like he adds gravitas, but also like, when he goes funny, I always find that really, really memorable.
Yeah.
It's like a dry, he's always so dry with the comedy. It's very, very funny because of how serious he plays everything, you know?
I think the thing that I remember him most for is in Boogie Nights, he's a pornographer in that film. Mm-hmm. And he has a line where he says, quote, "I like butter in my ass and lollipops in my mouth," end quote, which is an incredible line. And then coming out of somebody that looks like Philip Baker Hall, you know?
Yeah.
You expect that to come out of a person like a 20-year-old, you know, like somebody saying something that wild and graphic, you know, that's what you expect. And then for him to say it, I just remember it made a huge impression on me when I saw it. I was like, wow, like this guy is game for anything as an actor. You know?
Yeah.
So what an amazing talent. But yeah, Philip Baker Hall passed away. Very sad. We also learned recently that Ray Liotta passed away.
Well, it's been a couple weeks too.
Yeah.
So it's, I'm still like reeling from his loss because it was so surprising.
Probably the most iconic role Ray Liotta had was Goodfellas, right?
Mm-hmm.
The protagonist of Goodfellas, but he's been in a ton of amazing stuff in the past few years as well. I remember him very vividly in Killing Them Softly. I thought he was great in that. He was also in, I think, Marriage Story. He played the lawyer in Marriage Story.
So good. Whenever he shows up in a bit part, he's so good. Have you guys ever seen Something Wild, the Jonathan Demme movie?
Yeah, no? Long, long, long time ago.
Okay. But his performance in that is like, he pops up as like the crazed-eyed, villain boyfriend. And he is just incredible in that. That movie is fantastic. You should watch that, Dave.
Something Wild.
Yeah, the Jonathan Demme.
Just recently, the Many Saints of Newark, he playing two characters that are so different. What a
He was so
cool
good there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he was so good in that.
So good.
Yeah, because you're right. Because each of those characters was like dramatically. I forgot. You know, the movie did not make much of an impression, but his performance did.
He is going to be in that upcoming. His last thing is going to be the Blackbird show that's going to be on Apple TV Plus, and that's Dennis Lehane doing like a crime TV show. So I'm very eager to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
so young he died. I mean, it just feels very young.
It was surprising because he was in the middle of working, right? He was shooting something and he died in his sleep basically. And we kept seeing him, right? It's one of those things where it's like, oh man, we expected him to be around for a long time because he seemed to have hit a really good groove recently.
Yeah. Yeah. He really was having a renaissance for him, you know?
Yeah. 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 He passed away at the age of 67, but
so young.
Yeah. Anyway. Enormous talents these folks are, and we're grateful that we've been able to experience their work. You know, it's something that has, it seems like Ray Liotta, Philip Baker Hall, their work has been a key part of our cinematic upbringings.
For sure.
Tommy Vercetti himself, like Ray Liotta was everywhere, GTA, you know?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's anything I do remember him in a lot of stuff. Like, I remember his brains getting eaten in Hannibal.
Yes. Remember that? Yes. I remember that.
He's in the most wild scene of that movie, which is somebody's brains getting eaten while he's still alive. What a weird thing. Anyway, but yeah, Goodfellas.
Goodfellas.
Incredible.
Incredible. Field of Dreams. Field of Dreams is a movie. Field of Dreams. About.
Yeah.
But him in Field of Dreams is very good.
Yeah. That's a great one. And when he played Sinatra in the Rat Pack, which I thought was, he did a great Sinatra. No, disagree, Dave?
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. But every time this happens, I'm like, I got to go back and watch some of these films too, because I remember him being very good in Copland. Just tremendous. Yeah. And Narc.
Narc. Oh my gosh, Narc. So good. But yeah, for Goodfellas, I'm trying to think like, trying to articulate what it was he brought to that film, right? And I think it was this openness and excitement that came with, you know, as long as I can remember. I wanted to call it
psychotic charisma. I think that's what it is.
Well, and then it morphs into this edge, right?
He's a good-looking guy. You want to hang out with him. He loves to laugh in that movie, but a sheer psychopath. Like, there's something in his eyes that's a little, like, hard edge, and that Something Wild really tapped into that a lot too.
Well, and the transformation he goes through in that movie is really remarkable too, right? I mean, he starts out as guy on the up and up, and
he starts out as the audience surrogate, right? He starts out as the guy you relate to, is like just this normal guy who gets involved in these crazy people, and then he turns into one of the crazy people.
And it's remarkable. And like, I just remember seeing him when he enters his Coke era in that movie, that character, and just being amazed at the extent of the physical transformation. I guess like a large part of it is makeup, right? But he's just
makeup. He's very sweaty.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of super sweaty and pale. Yeah. And I just remember it being like, wow, like a guy who at one point in this earlier in this film was riding high and living the life of Riley being laid so low because of his vices and addictions. You know, it's a remarkable transformation and a remarkable performance. Obviously one of the greatest films of all time. So, okay. Well, anyway, I thought, we should just talk about those guys a little bit because they're so awesome. And, we really appreciated their work. So Ray Liotta and Philip Baker Hall, rest in peace. You will be missed. All right, folks, let's get to our main conversation today, which is going to be about Barry season 3. I have some very complex thoughts about this. I'm struggling with this one a little bit.
Really?
I have some thoughts. I'm curious to talk to you guys about it. But Devendra, I think you're probably the hottest on this one.
Very, very hot.
So tell us about the hotness, Devendra.
Although I will say, I will say up front, I wish the finale was a little longer. It felt a little perfunctory.
You kind of want a 45-minute, 60-minute finale, right? But every episode is like very disciplined 30, 35 minutes.
The question is this a series finale?
No.
It certainly feels like it.
Yeah.
Well, we should say to begin with, we are going to spoil everything through Barry season 3. So if you haven't seen it, you should. You should watch it. It's one of the most interesting things on TV right now. But we are going to spoil everything through Barry season 3. So you have been warned. But I would agree with you, Jeff. It could be a series finale. It has already been renewed for season 4, and Bill Hader is apparently directing every episode, and that's going to be very interesting, I think.
It's extraordinary that they feel like they can continue this for another season. Like,
wild.
I mean, it feels like they're leaving it where we kind of know where everybody is, and if there was never another episode of, I'm glad there's more, but if there was never another episode of Barry, I feel like, oh my gosh, I kind of know where everybody sits in a certain way.
And I'm kind of worried about season 4. Like, will it extend the show past the point when it makes sense?
That's always the worry. I feel like 4 seasons is usually the sweet spot. 4 or 5 seasons for a good high concept show. Once you go past that, that was the Lost problem. That was so many other things. They wanted to end that show at 4 seasons. So we'll see.
Yeah. So that's what I'm most worried about is if they ended now, I'd feel quite satisfied. I'd feel like, oh wow, that was a great journey, super satisfying, very well done. And
I don't know about that. I think especially after the finale, where I'm like, I need a little more. I need a little more, because this whole season has been doing a great job of giving us, like, really funny stuff, really dramatic stuff, some great action. I just felt like I wanted more. So yeah, they would have needed a movie follow up or something for me to feel fully satisfied if this was the end of the show.
I don't know. We're in full spoilers.
Yeah,
right?
We're in full spoilers now.
So there's a moment in the final episode where, Barry turns to Sally and he's like, I know where I'm going. Like, I know where I'm going to end up.
Yeah.
And I feel like, clearly there is more, right? They're doing another season. But for me, that felt like an indication of, we don't need to spell this out for you. He's being hauled away by the cops. Things are not ending well for this man. You know, like if it had ended there, I feel like that moment would have been the denouement, that sort of hinting at what a denouement would have been. It feels like that finality for Barry, where he has realized he's evil. He knows where he's headed. He's had that like existential moment. That near death experience, and now his upence has come.
We rarely agree on things, Jeff, but I am in a complete 100% alignment with what you're saying. I feel the same way as you. But Devendra, tell us more about why you like this show in particular this season.
I mean, I think we all like the show, but this season, what I've always loved about Barry is that it dances on the knife edge of, extreme comedy, a lot of weirdness, and like out of nowhere, very, very serious stuff, very serious drama. I think the turning point of the show for me was, the first season where he ends up having to kill his friend, right? Like his friend who just cannot keep it together. And that comes fully back in this season. But that episode where he just kills his friend in the car, right? And I don't know if he walks away or not, but I remember that shot of just him saying like, why did you say that?
Yeah.
Have to kill my friend. And that like really told us, like, as much as we want to root for Barry, he is still like a cold-blooded killer. Like, he's not a good guy, even though he is trying to be a nice guy. So I found that balance always to be really, really fascinating. This season really pushed that to like whole new heights, right? Like the second episode, you have his outburst against Sally, which, a reminder, not a great guy, actually. Like he's going through stuff, and we love Barry, and he's funny, and yada yada yada. And I love how Bill Hader portrays him, but that was a stark reminder that this guy is bad. Like he is just like he has a lot of issues going on. The whole reaction of the room around him, and the like, was it the younger writer who like
co-star,
who like was really shocked by what happened. The way
who's played by Elsie Fisher, the main actor in Eighth Grade, by the way.
Oh yeah, yeah, he looks familiar.
Yeah, I think this is the season where they clearly made the decision like, there's not going to be any ambiguity about the moral center of Barry. Like we've decided he is reprehensible.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we're going to make that very clear.
And he is acknowledging it. But at the same time, there are some tremendously hilarious bits in this season. Like just every episode just has one thing that I can't stop laughing at. I'm thinking of like the Vanessa Bayer pitch scene.
Yes. So good.
Just
so
good. Which, oh man.
And I think show business satire stuff is really sharp this season. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
There's been so many movies or TV shows that Hollywood is about Hollywood, you know, that is self-reflexive or even making fun of itself. I don't think it has ever been better than in this show. Like the junket sequence from this season is so perfect. Hey girl, you know, that all that, like, I mean,
because somebody, all of us have kind of participated in that too.
Yes. We've all been there, and it's so perfectly spot on about like how it's an excruciating experience for everyone involved.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about that scene. First of all, I mean, my understanding is Bill Hader very much came up in this. He was very much into sites like Ain't It Cool News and this whole web culture.
He's a huge film nerd too.
Right, he's a huge film nerd. So he speaks from experience, and there were so many things about that entire sequence that were amazing. One of them is the person like asks one or two questions, like "How's it going?" And you know, what would you say inspired you to make this thing? Okay, we're done. You know, like it's
you only
get like 10 minutes sometimes to talk with a person, and
5 minutes sometimes. Yeah. Well, and
it's so great how Sally before that sequence is so worried about how these questions are going to come up, and oh my gosh, are they going to ask me these hard hitting things? And literally, no, everyone's asking the most fluff garbage question, and that's how it always is. It's
yeah, and then there was a question about like, hey, you know, would you? It was a Marvel movie question. It was like, what do you think Terrence Malick thinks about Marvel or something like that? Or would you direct a Marvel or something?
No, it was like who should play the next Spider-Man?
She
says Ben Mendelsohn.
which is the name of the episode.
Episode. But
look on the journalist at that point is like just complete not computing.
Ben
but also
Mendelsohn, the greatest Spider-Man.
Like, just a joke. It's a joke of a guy's name, but incredible. Yeah.
But I
it's
mean, you also know the article that got written about that answer afterwards.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It's going to be trending on Twitter that day.
So brilliant. It's so brilliant because, like, Ben Mendelsohn, first of all, funny sounding name for her to come out with. Just such a random pull. But then, like, when you really think about it, he's way too old. So wrong for Spider-Man in so many ways.
Very, very like, dirty, never playing a good guy.
Yes,
you know?
she's this actor who's very much into being an actor, and so she pulls like this great actor name out of her ass. It's like it's so perfect on so many levels.
It's very
and
good.
I think that's the show. The show is like, how did they hone in on this, like the gem of an abstraction that tells you so much with so little? Like that to me is Barry, is a camera move or a tiny little piece of dialogue or just a scene or a moment that explains so much with so little.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the show does so well, I think.
Yep. I mean, they know they only have 30 minutes, right? Or 25 to 30 minutes. So it's like, I feel like they're always
working. Well, you really appreciate the discipline.
That.
You know, like after seeing so many shows that have a 45 minute, 60 minute, 70 minute runtime. It's like every episode was like 30, 35 minutes. It's like, wow, yeah. they really, yeah.
I haven't
they
seen make... Stranger Things this season, but apparently it's going into like feature length runtime. Yeah, there's like 90 minute episodes.
Long episodes this season of Stranger Things. So, yeah.
Yeah, and how they can express a character so immediately and so thoroughly and so perfectly. Mm-hmm. I mean, even side characters. Like, one of my favorite characters is the assistant police detective guy who just completely buys into the Raven as a concept and is like 100% sold, you know? And there's such a perfect line in the last episode where he's like in the background of a frame. He's not even in the foreground. He's blurred out. And he goes, has anybody seen the
FBI agent? The FBI,
right, yeah. He's like, yeah. No, he left right after cocking his gun. He's probably out doing some.
He's probably doing tourist stuff.
Haven't seen him since he stormed out after cocking his gun, basically, was what he said.
He's probably seeing the sights.
It's so, so perfect. And I feel like that last episode had so many things like that. Mm-hmm. The sequence with fucking Tiger or whatever it is on the other side of the wall that the show knows we don't need to see it. We don't need to be explained it. It's just so disturbing and so weird and so off-putting. And then he walks out and they're like clearly trying to do this like deprogramming, you know, get the gay out type of a situation, mm-hmm. by electrocuting but like it doesn't need to be spelled out. We just get it in these abbreviated little moments. I've never seen a show mm-hmm. that trusts the audience more than this one does.
I think like the best example of this is Mitch the Beignet guy.
Yes.
Right. Where I was listening to commentary around that episode. It's like apparently they had several scenes of all those characters who go to him, right? Of just like meeting somebody in the park, doing exposition, you know, in various scenarios. Whereas it's just one guy, like one really wise Beignet guy. And it is hilarious. It is just so funny. And it's also like giving us character work at the same time. I don't know. This show just kept impressing.
And the detail of how everybody who's standing in line to talk to the Beignet guy is by themselves. Like they're there to get the beignets, but they're also there for the advice.
Yeah, they're there to talk to him. But the entire final episode, you know, you mentioned the Panther sequence. The entire final episode is a tour through various, I guess, dramatic techniques/exercises. Mm-hmm. My understanding, Jeff, you would probably know more about this than me, is like that interrogation scene, which is incredible.
It's Meisner.
It's a Meisner technique, right?
Yeah. It's a Meisner. I did that in fucking acting school, guys.
Yeah, so tell us about what Meisner exercises are.
Mm. It's repetition. You do a repetition exercise. You say the lines that you have to say in your dialogue. You take like two or three lines of dialogue and you just say them back and forth to the point where they lose their meaning entirely. And mm-hmm. you're just kind of breaking down your assumptions and your any kind of meaning that you are putting on top of it until the words are just sounds. And then it the intention is to get to something deeper where you're communicating without artifice. And mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who have very strong opinions about Meisner technique, but what an incredible sequence to I mean, I've said it before when we've talked about Barry, but it bears repeating. As somebody who moved to Los Angeles, lived in the Valley, in Sherman Oaks and Studio City and Van Nuys and all the places that are central to this show, because this is a show that is about Los Angeles, but it takes place in the Valley, which is very different than Hollywood, than Santa Monica, than the West Side. It is... LA is regional and is very, very different. And because it takes so long to get from one place to another, these places have their own identity and you get stuck in them. And this show knows all that stuff. And it feels like it is made for such a narrow audience because mm-hmm. I'm telling you guys, I wish I could express to you, I know Gene Cousineau. I've taken a class with all of those people that mm-hmm. is exactly like that class. Exactly. And how it nails that experience, those people's behaviors mm-hmm. and self-delusions and all of that weird LA vibe, it is it is abstracted, it is accentuated, it is played for comedy, but it is so authentic. I mean, the show is...
How would you characterize the difference between Hollywood versus the Valley, by the way? Because you're saying it's very different, and I believe you. I'm just trying to understand, like, how would you characterize the difference?
Well, I mean, so much of this show, the fact that they shoot it in all those locations, like the way all of those apartments are on top of each other and those apartment buildings are everywhere. Like that scene where he goes and he buzzes the door in that apartment, which is like, I know where that apartment building is in Sherman Oaks. It's like, and the guy, you know, sees the mom and kid, which is just such a tiny throwaway side story that they're going to murder Barry and then they accidentally shoot each other in the car. Like,
man,
that whole sequence is genius. But anyway, I'm sidetracking. This feeling of being sort of trapped in the Valley and how there's all these little acting studios that are in alleys, like Barry being like
strip mall kind of
yes,
style,
passing out in that back alley. Like all of those places have that little alley where the garbage is and everybody walks out there to get a cigarette. And there's like, it's dude, it has that feeling of the deep Valley. And the kinds of acting teachers that are based there are not the kind of acting teachers that can afford the Studio City, excuse me, the Santa Monica studios. You know, there's a completely different West Hollywood acting coach than there is the Van Nuys Sherman Oaks acting coach. And like Cousineau is that guy, you know, the complete failure that reinvents himself as a guru. It is that experience writ large.
He's so good, by the way. The masterclass introduction and everything by him.
He needs an Emmy. He needs an Emmy for the season.
Incredible stuff.
Yeah. So returning back to the finale episode, you have the Meisner exercise, which is obviously incredible. I think it's mostly done in one shot, if I recall correctly.
Well, and then that cut into the when he leans in really tight and he looks at another man when he asks him a question.
Amazing acting.
Incredible.
Then you have a person being murdered, but you don't hear it. And then you have a person being murdered, but you don't see it.
Yeah, the person being murdered that you don't hear it in the voiceover studio that you have built in your apartment. Like, unbelievable.
Right. And
unbelievable.
So a really good one, too. Very silent. Like, nothing's leaking through there. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Like, really? Trust
really
me.
Really? Shockingly well done.
I have spent a considerable amount of time on sound dampening technology for my new office, and that place, they clearly did an amazing job, because it is hard to do that. So it invites the audience to like, hey, imagine visually what this death would be, then imagine, you know, sonically what this death would be. And it just feels like it's kind of like taking you through all these various, it's challenging the audience in all these different ways, right? In all these kind of dramatic ways. And I really appreciated it for that. Okay.
I was worried they were going to go full on, they're going to kill Sally here, which worried
me. Oh my gosh, yes.
Dude,
yeah,
that
because
sequence.
It felt like they were going to fridge her, and I thought this show was too smart for that. And what ends up happening is brilliant.
And well, every other show or movie that does that moment has her being choked, cut to the knife on the floor, back to her being choked, cut to her fingers trying to get to the knife, cut back to her being... And this show is fucking so much better than that. It's so much better. And again, it subverts expectations. It abbreviates these moments. It does things in ways that give you credit as a viewer, because as soon as she stabs him in the neck, we know we wrote all that scene in our head. We know how that all happened. We don't need it to be spelled out. And it is even more powerful that we go, yes, of course she grabbed that knife. And yes, of course they sourced it when he walked in the door. Yes, I make those connections. Oh my God, that's so much more satisfying because I'm participating.
Even the way she gets him is really unique too, because it's like through the neck and clearly like to an optic nerve or something, right? Like is through the neck and up to his eye area.
You've never seen an injury like that before. Yeah.
And how he reacts is so this show, right? Barry, it's absurd, it's bizarre, but it somehow feels right, you know? I just think this show is working on another level. It's so good. It's so perfect. I can't get over how I'm surprised to hear you guys have reservations, because I just think this shows a work of genius.
I have no reservations.
No, Dominguez has no reservations. I have reservations.
The finale to be longer. Like I wanted a more fuller experience, but I also know they're saving a lot for next season. So
yeah,
I'm in anticipation for whatever.
I have reservations. Mm-hmm. Jeff, do not attack. Try your best. Do not attack me. Do not attack me.
Here we go.
Try your best. I know it might not work out, but try your best. Do not attack me. Okay. I love this show. I think it's incredible. I'd recommend it unreservedly to pretty much anyone I know. Okay, so let's start with there. I have no major issues with the show. The thing that I am reflecting on and thinking about as
I fuck you, Dave!
How dare you?
The thing I am reflecting on and thinking about is is there a coherent purpose for the journey that the show is taking us on?
Mm-hmm.
This show begins as kind of, ooh, like, ha ha ha, Hitman, you know, tries to be an actor and like, this is ripe for comedy.
And we've seen that story before too. The disaffected Hitman, like doing
Gross Point
like,
Blank.
Get Shorty. Yeah.
Gross Point Blank. Yeah,
Get Shorty. Exactly, so many different things. Yeah.
Yeah. And at first, I'm like, oh, this is, in fact, really funny, right? Mm-hmm, but then even in season one with him killing his friend, and then I think is it season one or two where he murders Detective Moss? Isn't it season one? It's season two.
Oh, sorry. I think it's two.
Isn't it the end of season one when he murders Detective Moss? I mean, anyway.
It could be.
I
can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the end of season one.
Yeah, it's the end of season one. So it's, but anyway, yeah, that was like 4 years ago, so that's why it's hard for us to remember. But anyway. But it already has these kind of like serious sort of elements to it. And I'm like, oh, it's doing a like really good job, in my opinion, of balancing kind of some more serious elements with a very goofy side, right? This season was a full on descent into hell, which I am okay with. I'm not opposed to any of that. Like if you want to change the story on me, that's totally cool. Like, and I think some of the most interesting stuff that's happened in this show, in Better Call Saul, and even in a show like Ozark, which is a show I despise, has occurred.
Wait, who's attacking who now?
has occurred because like, they've taken a character who you thought one way about and like made them irredeemable. Like that is interesting, in my opinion, right? For a show to do that. But season three finale is so dark. The analog that I felt was best for it, for my own emotional experience, was honestly Requiem for a Dream. that is how I felt watching season three. I mean,
it's Requiem for a Dream with jokes.
With jokes.
a handful of jokes. Not even that many in the finale, but you have these characters who are like literally you have multiple characters in shock in this like literal shock in this episode. Sally coming out of the recording booth and she's like it's incredible that performance.
She looks like she has died basically.
Right.
Like
super
that
up close,
shot, the
right?
way yeah. that yeah, the way that shot with that lens right on her face.
Yeah.
It's
and
incredible.
Then Barry kind of collapsing you know at the in the midpoint with I think it's Albert, the Asian dude, right? Like and he just kind of collapses and he is like completely defeated and has hit rock bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hank and Cristobal, you know, Hank murdering Cristobal's wife and the dancer and them doing like the aversion therapy or whatever it is. The gay, you know,
electrocuted
therapy.
Away.
Yeah, yeah. Electrocuting. Yeah. Like, and then he kind of gives him this hug and it's like each of these moments reminds me of something like similar to Requiem for a Dream when like these people have been like, this is the lowest we have ever seen these people.
Yeah. You cannot go back from these choices.
Yes,
basically.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well,
right.
I think that's the discovery that the show seems to have made in season three is we've had fun and games with our, you know, wacky hitman, but it's like being a hitman is reprehensible.
Yeah. He is irredeemable from the start. Technically.
Yeah. And I think the show recognizes that and goes, hey, all the fun we've been having, now it's time to pay the pauper. You know,
I think that is really that I agree with you thematically that's what the show is trying to do, right? It's like and I think Catherine Van Arendonk at Vulture wrote a great piece where she's like, the purpose of this season was to illustrate every death has an impact.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right? Exactly.
And it does so in kind of a funny way, right? Where one of my favorite subplots is Fuchs kind of Every having time. The same fairy tale thing happen to him twice.
Yeah,
but
turning
also
it down both times.
The curse is that he cannot escape like his revenge. Like he can have a happy life with a beautiful lady in some like remote area, and he gets that chance twice, and he's just like, no, I reject this.
Well, it's
happiness.
So funny because the reason he rejects it is because he's like, you know, God or universe or whatever, give me a sign, and you'd think the sign would be having a fairy tale presented to you twice. But no, the sign is a newspaper on the bottom of the truck.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
And but, every one of those scenes is so like hilariously constructed too, right? Because it is like from a very stereotypical movie. The father saying, I think you're a good man. The man he found shot in the desert.
Yes. And he's like 5 minutes away from LA, but he's like, you know, in Dances with Wolves all of a sudden. You know?
My daughter would like to be boyfriend and girlfriend.
that line is so
beautiful. Napoleon Dynamite too. It's like
But I think the last time I can recall something like this is like The Sopranos, right?
Mm-hmm. Breaking Bad, man. Like Breaking Bad was
not even Breaking Bad, but I bring up The Sopranos specifically because there was a tension between David Chase, the creator of Sopranos, mm-hmm. and the audience. Because here's the thing, the audience loved Tony Soprano, right? Tony Soprano's an amazing guy. When bad things happen to the Soprano family, the audience is like, oh, I feel bad. Mm-hmm. And David Chase, particularly in the last few seasons, tried extremely hard to remind you these are horrifying human beings.
Yeah,
right.
Every single one of them is terrible. You should not root for any of these people.
Right.
But even Chase didn't go as hard as Barry season 3, in my opinion. Right? And so that's the thing. Barry season 3 goes real hard. It is arguably traumatizing. Bill Hader mm-hmm. has said people who were working on the show had panic attacks watching the final episode, right? And on some level, I feel like, okay, when you're doing stuff like this, the purpose of something like this is to indict the viewer in some way. It's like, you should never have rooted for Barry. Like, how dare you have, rooted for Barry in any way?
No. I think you're overstating
I think you're putting
it.
Something on the show there, yeah.
Okay, I mean it's my reading of the show that like the reason to go this hard is because you're trying to say something of like, you know, you every death has an impact. We should never laugh at people who are assassinated.
No.
In shows.
I just think you're,
and meanwhile,
you're
the show has spent two seasons prior to this making us laugh at these hilarious situations where people are killed.
It's a half step back from what you're saying. It's just as you said, reminding the viewer like these are horrible things. These are horrible things. It's not we should never have had fun. It's like, okay, we had our fun, but let's remember these people's lives have been destroyed. And look at the circles of lives that surround these lives that have also been destroyed.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I get that. But my point was that if you had a show that was not funny, that was like a dramatic show, right? And you had a hitman trying to be an actor, and it's not funny. He's not. There's no Gene Cusano. It's like a funny. It's like a serious thing, and he's just murdering a ton of people. Right. My inclination would be to feel sad about that. Like my immediate feelings would be, wow, that's sad and tragic.
But the people he has killed were never done for laughs, right? Those core people, his friend, even the guy from the acting studio, right? Which he didn't kill, but he kind of tangentially responsible. I don't think it was ever done for comedy. Janice Moss, like. That's been drama the whole time.
Great point. Yeah. I agree. That's a great point, Devendra. But I guess my point is like, I would not laugh. Like, I would not find that amusing at all. And I think you're right that like many of the main deaths aren't played for laughs. So there are some deaths that are played for laughs, though, right?
They never really come back to haunt him, I guess. But I don't know.
But that is what I would already feel, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea that I need it to be hammered in this way feels only necessary if like the reason you do stuff like this creatively is if you feel the audience has not gotten the point.
I don't know.
And it feels the only reason I wouldn't have gotten the point is because the show is trying to be a comedy.
I think dramatically interesting is the thing. Like the logical endpoint for these characters and where you've taken them and the like crazy alchemy you have in the show of comedy and drama, they had to lean hard on drama here. I'm worried that season 4 will be just more drama and losing the comedy a bit, but they're smarter. Like they've proven themselves at this point to be able to balance this stuff. And it's that knife edge dance is what I really appreciate about this show.
Well, Jeff, go ahead. Mm-hmm. I think part of the dramatic fun or interest or raison d'etre, right? If you're looking for the reason that this show is doing what it's doing, I think part of the dance that constantly happens with any show like this is, ooh, how's he going to get out of this one? Right? Yeah, that's that's The Sopranos. That's Breaking Bad. It's always, how are they going to get out of this one? And what I think the fun of Barry is doing that and then constantly subverting that play, right? Because in this episode, the final episode, you have that exact thing happen. Like, he collapses in the desert with the one guy who's figured it all out and has him dead to rights, has a gun pulled on him, literally watching him dump a body into a hole, you know, like, could not be more hand in the cookie jar, right?
I do wonder how he found him, but yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They never explained that, I don't think.
I love how the show just doesn't explain that. Like, this guy is just so good at his job and knows Barry. Of course.
I found your corpse tree, Barry. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's a place they used to go to and hang out. I don't know. Who knows?
But it's like the show knows, hey, you can fill in that much. All that matters is this guy's really good at his job, right? And anyway, so not to sidetrack, how is he going to get out of this one? Oh my God, the guy's letting him off the hook. All you have to do, Barry, is never do this again.
Yes.
All that has to happen is you walk away right now. And this is the moment where Barry has learned his lesson. He's had a near-death experience. He's seen the light. He's watched his girlfriend almost die from his choices. He's come to the light. All he has to do is walk away. And then at the end, he doesn't do that, right? He does. How's he going to get out of this one? Oh, he doesn't, because Cousineau sets him up, plays it, you know, does acting at him, right? Yeah. Which is like how he gets him is by acting, right? So perfect. And I think, to me, what you're saying, Dave, about how it's, you know, wagging its finger at the audience, I don't see it that way. I feel like it's, hey, remember how horrible this man is, but now the dramatic, ooh, how's he going to get out of this one, has so much more weight, because you go, should he get out of this one? I think the feeling that I had in the desert was, are they going to let him off the hook this easy?
Yeah.
Like, all he has to do is walk away now? No. The show, of course, is much smarter than that, puts him in an even worse situation, and like, it's always subverting. It's always taking your expectation and doing something different.
I don't disagree with anything you just said. I think that's all bang on. You know, maybe I'm doing a bad job of articulating myself, which is very, very possible, right? But I think it's more like, okay, at the end of all this, what was gained, right? What was learned at the end of all this, right? And when I watch The Sopranos, I'm like, okay, I learned a lot from that show. I learned a lot about this kind of culture and the idea of like a sort of certain flavor of toxic masculinity that reinforces itself. And I feel that way. The thing that I think is most sharp, most enlightening about this show is the show business stuff. Right. And there is this really challenging subplot this season about how, Elsie Fisher's character saw Bill Hader's character being super abusive, and what does she do? But she doesn't want to say anything because it could jeopardize the show and jeopardize her career. Like, it's just better to say nothing. You know, that's all interesting stuff and really well done, I think. Right. So I'm not saying the show has nothing to say, but this stuff about the Barry character himself, I think, is just a little bit more hazy for me. That's all I'm saying. It's like, Barry is bad. Yes. And theoretically we should have known since season one, as you guys pointed
out. I think we did.
And now we definitely know. And it's like, okay, I guess that's kind of interesting, but I already kind of knew that, you know, like, the only reason to go this hard is if you thought we didn't know that.
Barry live with himself? I think that is it, because this show from the beginning was an existential crisis, right? And now he is successful. He's like a successful actor, even though he has lost Sally because of his behavior. Like, he is vaguely successful. Like, he is almost living his dream. This season begins with like the end of last season was basically Cousineau learning that Barry killed Janice, right? So that, how they reckoned with that, was the big challenge I was like trying to see early on in the season. I think, I don't know if it's believable, but it's certainly like dramatically interesting that he is just trying to redeem himself by helping Cousineau be successful, you know, like that is his payback. And Cousineau, to a certain degree, is taking it, you know, despite like the soul crushing nature of all this and how scared he is of Barry, he wants that too.
Yeah, that part is interesting. This idea that of how intoxicating Hollywood is, basically, mm-hmm. right? Like that it is so intoxicating that you're willing to overlook literally the threat of physical danger.
This man killed the woman you love.
Yeah, exactly.
But you'll still work with him.
I think there is clearly a parallel being drawn throughout the course of all three seasons between, you know, the sort of hitman mentality of Hollywood of kill or be killed, do anything it takes to survive, do anything it takes to be successful with, you know, literal hitmen, right? I think that is not subtle. And I think some of what's happening in season three, which you see through Gene Cousineau's transformation, is, hey, maybe be nice to people.
Mm-hmm. Don't be a dick.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you see him come through the other side and be kind and like be selfless and promote other people, like take his success and push it forward onto that that director that he screwed over years ago, all that stuff. And then you see the opposite happening with Sally, right? Where she gets successful and then she just becomes a monster, right? Mm-hmm. And I think those themes are really powerful and I think give reason for sort of the darkness as you see how horrible people can be to one another. And Barry in the middle of all that, like trying to be nice, trying also being evil. It's that, you know, angel devil on his shoulder that's happening too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will say that on that note, one of the most interesting parts of the show is this idea that a sociopathic murderer is scary, but even more scary is a sociopathic murderer who thinks he's a good person.
Right. Yes.
You know, like that is even in some ways more scary and more upsetting because they're so because they can do things that they think are good, but are in fact actually terrible.
Like that speech where he lays out how he can walk in and take a picture and like how it's just sort of like matter of fact and positive. Right. He thinks that is.
I was thinking of the scene where he's like, trying to get the opening stuff where he's trying to get Cousineau's career back, you know? And, he's like, you know, say like, tell me you love me, Mr. Cousineau. And like, I love you. And it's just like
driving him around in the trunk the whole time. Just
yes.
Like,
it's crazy. Yes. And so anyway, I hope I have tried to make the case.
I got you. Not even against
Barry. It's because even at the worst, my case is like, hey, this is an exceptionally well-executed show that is a really good genre exercise. That is the worst case scenario of what I'm saying.
But look at I hope you don't feel attacked.
No.
I mean, other than the fact that you're wrong 100%.
Other than I'm dead wrong and I should feel bad about my opinion.
Yeah. Other than that. Yeah,
the standard stuff.
I think Sally's arc in season three is pretty impressive, is pretty amazing. Like, she is just consumed by narcissism.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In a situation where she should be completely, she's achieved her dreams, which, you know, the show makes the point, like you never do, right. Achieving your dream is not an end point. But also, she's creating the show that's sort of this very positive thing. And her co-star thinks it's such this amazing positive reflection of life and, you know, the struggle of women and it can be a positive force in the world. And yet that scene where she accepts the award on stage is so excruciating because she makes it all about herself.
Yeah.
Right. And it's what Hollywood does to people. I think that there's so many wonderful facets of this show that are more than kind of what you've expressed, you know, on the basis level of its darkness and its, you know, how difficult it is to watch.
One thing I also want to point out is like this season becomes basically another entry in Park Chan-wook's like a revenge trilogy. You know, it is about the futility of revenge and the different forms it can take and how it can consume you and your life. And sometimes you may end up shooting your son in the leg. And sometimes you may consider like where you are in life and like drive the guy who killed your son to the hospital while having this crisis, you know, and that whole speech between the father of is it Chris?
Amazing.
I forget which guy it was, but the father who basically dropped him off has this thing about, like, you know, what you would do for your child, and not thinking like you could love anyone else more than your child. And that just felt like it rang really true too as well. So I do love that this show has room for that stuff, right? The impact of violence and how it affects other people. That was the big thing this season.
Agreed.
All right.
Well, we got a few more things I want to talk about.
Oh yeah, please.
One of which we haven't even talked about episode 6 and that incredible chase sequence through basically the route to Pasadena, which is a freeways I've driven 1,000 times. And the fact that they shot it there, and I mean, you read about how they did it. They did it like 4 days. They shot it, those freeways down in the morning or super early. Like, the fact that they shot it on the actual freeways in Los Angeles that take you to those places, and how that shot, the way the camera is behind the motorcycle, and you, and there's no score. It's only scored by sound effects and the
silence.
I mean, I watched it in my little home movie theater that has awesome audio and surround sound, and like the sound of those cars passing by is incredible.
Just wild. And his little bike is like broken too, and you can hear it. It's the engine isn't revving as much as everybody else's, but he's still going. I was reminded of one of my favorite chase sequences is Terminator 2's, the motorcycle in the like waterway. Mm-hmm. And that shot just like following him into the highway just felt very reminiscent of that too.
Yeah. But people describe Bill Hader's directorial style as a sort of detached realism. And I think that's so spot on. Like I love how he plays things out, and you just feel like you're this observer of something extraordinary. Like he does these long takes, the camera is kind of pulled back, and you're just watching this thing unfold that is absurd, but feels like it could happen. And I am enamored with his directorial style.
Into the car dealership, I think, is the best example. Like, it felt like a GTA sequence, right? It was like the car dealer's like sees the guy on the ceiling, is like, not today, not today. I'm gonna go get my shotgun.
And again,
shoots the guy. Well, the crowd was like, he's back up. He's back up.
We learned so much about that character. We don't know who that character is. We've never met that character, but you immediately are like, oh, dude, that is not the first time this has happened to that guy.
But also, once this is all over, everybody's like, they calm down. They start to go back into the car dealership, too. It's like, this happens all the time. Everyone's used to this, I guess.
Well, I will say I agree with... I hate to be the person who's like, you know, disagreeing. I mean, I actually really love that episode. One of the things, first of all, Bill Hader gave a series of extremely lengthy interviews to Adam Chitwood over at The Wrap. I'll link to it in the show notes, but I would highly recommend. He basically does like a commentary on every single episode, and it's incredible. It's like super, it's like a mini film school, basically.
He's doing that for one of the Ringer podcasts too. So he's talking about it everywhere.
So, but I'd recommend checking those out. And one of the things he talked about for this episode is those people that go in on the dividing lines, right? In the highway, like motorcycles that travel in between cars.
Yeah.
And he was saying like how that's always like terrifying to him when he sees that happen.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying to me too. And I think this episode really captured that, right? The idea of like, how dangerous it is to be riding a motorcycle and like weaving in and out of traffic like that. It felt like Matrix Reloaded in some ways, but in a much more realistic, grounded way. Right? And so totally. I thought the sequence was really well done.
And that moment where the guy's like, handoff, it just goes horribly.
Yeah. They didn't talk that over in advance.
No, that's amazing.
I have to say, I did find the sequence a little bit difficult to watch because it happened. I believe it happened. Days at the episode aired like a day or days after the Uvalde shooting. And it's not that I feel like, you know, if any shootings at all, you know, prevented me from watching and enjoying media in America, I wouldn't be watching and enjoying anything. But it's more like the idea of this hearing the response is like, oh, we need to arm teachers. And the idea that a good guy with a gun can solve a mass shooting problem is like it's basically a myth according to research.
I mean, it's I think the show both balances the absurdity of that too and the absurdity of our reality. Like that, that
I guess,
is
but at the end of the day, you the saw thing. A good guy with a gun take down this like basically terrorist, and so it did kind of rub me in the wrong way in that sense. But again, nothing I'm saying is against the craft of the show, right? Like the craft of the show is consistently top notch.
It turns out we live in a very crazy society too, so it's like the show reflects I think quite a bit.
No doubt. And I think it's honestly at its best when things are super exaggerated and to some degree zany. And and honestly, if that was the entire tone of the show, I'd find it much more easy to take. But then, like, the last two episodes have been so dark, you know?
So dark.
I mean, anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just think we talk about a masterclass in filmmaking. I mean, the way this show reveals things to the viewer, the way the camera moves to show, I mean, there's a shot in the final episode of them, you know, they're in Barry's apartment and the camera kind of turns and there's a man standing in the doorway and it, like how that plays out and neither of them see it, but we, the audience, see it. I mean, I could talk about shot after shot after shot about how this show presents information to the viewer, how it edits things out, how it makes, allows you to make the connections, you know, we talked about the scene with the father taking him to the hospital and having that sequence, and then it cuts, and then we see Barry on a stretcher being pulled into the thing, and we see in the deep background the guy dead in the car, and we know exactly what happened, right? Yeah. Time. I mean, this to me is the pinnacle of cinematic storytelling. It is putting so much faith in the viewer. It is creating these moments of drama and tension and release of tension and comedy in the way things are revealed. You know, there are so many times during this season where I was sitting watching the show by myself and I stood up and like started clapping because of how something was presented. The moment where they go into the voiceover booth and the door closes and we can't hear her beat hit the shit out of him with a baseball bat. Like, it's so poetic, and I use that word specifically because, you know, in poetry it's all about sort of removing the inessential, and I think that's what Barry does. Is it is just stripped down, and the most essential parts, the most essential camera moves, how, what the connections that are made are just perfect. I think the show is genius. I really do.
I will say this. I think it makes tons of interesting decisions, you know, and an example of that is the episode. I think it was, it might have been six, could have been seven, could have been five, but it was the one where Sally discovers that her old assistant is like doing her show, you know, and she has the meltdown.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where she finds her assistant, her former assistant, like in the writing room doing this bit in front of the room. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
She kind of leans, peers into the room, and it's shot and sound mixed like a horror film, right? Like
it's a peek into what is happening. Yeah.
Right. And just like, wow, like what an interesting way to do that scene where it's like that all the sound like fades out and you hear this like low frequency rumbling. And
you just hear Darcy Carden doing her thing.
Right.
Dude,
and then
everybody laughing.
The camera movement is like ultra slow, ultra slow, like the slowest the dolly can move. Right.
Yeah.
And that's just, and then the scene when she's in the elevator, you know, and I think it's like a pan over for you. You see her in the elevator by herself, and then you've seen that shot a million times, but nope, this one moves and the shot moves and turns over and she's in the elevator and she starts screaming at her. It's like, those are interesting directorial choices.
Incredible. Yeah.
And it's all really well done.
So. Another one I'll point out is, you know, the incredible sequence with Noho Hank, you know, in the room chained to the thing, hearing this horror happening on the other side of the wall. We see the wall start to break. Like, what is that? That's straight out of a crazy horror movie, right? That's unbelievable. So he breaks out, right? Walking down the hall with a gun, and we see out of focus, blurry, sort of backlit and weird, this body gyrating in this
looks
strange
like an alien
way.
Oh
dancing.
My God. Yeah. So good. It's like so unsettling.
Like what is happening down there?
Right.
Like we're in this crazy carnival world where there's a freaking clearly some sort of animal in the other room. Like anything, literally anything is possible right now. Mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
It's genius, man.
Really
it's
good genius. Stuff. Really good stuff. Jeff, any other thing? You it sounded like you had stuff you wanted to make sure we ran through. Anything else you want to take us through before we wrap up here?
Oh God. There's I definitely wanted to talk about episodes. I think episode 6 is for me the final episode was incredible too, but episode 6 was so great. I mean, I love I just want to like it's that Chris Farley thing, you know, where I'm just like, man, that was great. Wasn't that great? How great was that?
This is one of those shows where I end up watching every episode like several times, right?
Yeah.
Because it is so dense.
I agree. I would agree that this one does reward repeat viewings, you know, just because every camera move is so well considered. You kind of want to study it and see like
every joke, every line, everything. Yeah. Really.
The sequence when he's trying to blow up the house and he has to call customer support.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was very funny. You know, in the Slack film cast, there's some people who felt like that took it over the top to like.
I mean, yeah,
well, that's show over the top a little
into,
bit.
Like, it's a little
fantasy,
bit,
you know.
But that's territory. What's so amazing about this show is that it can go into pure farce, pure just parody. That is.
I spent a lot of time trying to think whether that would actually be possible in our world, like because I actually think there's a case to be made that. There's plenty of stuff that's available in the App Store or you can buy online that only is bad if you use it illegally.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And so the idea of a detonator app is not completely out of the question.
It's just a detonator. They don't know what you're attaching
it to. They don't know what you're detonating. You know, maybe you're detonating fireworks or something.
Yeah, right. Like, blow up some fish in the pond, you know?
I mean, but I think the show does that all the time, right? Every hardened, grizzled, awful bad guy is totally played as a goofball buffoon at some point. You know, there's no mustache twirling evil that isn't also goofy, you know, like even the sort of patriarch of the, not the Chechenians, but the other side,
the Bolivians,
When he comes and he's like, oh, the guys are going to, you know, they're going to go out and have some fun. You know, it's all, even when he's like dressing down Cristobal and you know that there's a menace to it and he's like threatening him, it's played as this kind of sitcom scene. And I mean, that to me is, it's so confident, and B, it's extraordinary that the show can get away with that, that it can be completely goofy. And I mean, NoHo Hank as a character is goofy. Like that is not even sitcom. Like that's beyond. He's just he's a complete cartoon character, right? But
who also has clearly murdered people in the past.
Yes, you know? But also like we also kind of works in this world, and we believe it, and we're rooting for him, and we care about him. And then when he hugs Cristobal at the end, and you know, there's that moment where he's hugging him, and it feels good, and then his eyes change, and maybe there's something else that just happened where he realizes, oh my God, we've passed through the Rubicon.
We've never seen him kill anybody. I feel like that moment may have been his first like actually, you know.
No, I think it is heavily implied with like the tattoos that he has that he he's done some shit, and you kind of get a glimpse of it I think in the beginning of season 2 when he shows up at Barry's actor studio and he's like, you do not want to cross me. And it's clear that to me, the invented backstory I have for Hank is like he's done and seen some really horrifying stuff, and part of his personality, at least, is a way to cope slash respond to that. You know,
I don't know, but I don't know. Yeah, because that look at the end was like, oh, violence that I have committed with my hand, not just like ordering it, you know, out to my minions. Yeah,
I think that's a completely legitimate read, Devendra. But I also think you could read it as this guy who has killed, maybe he never wanted to kill people again, or or maybe he was grasping the gravity of the situation, because it's not like they can just be together and everything's great at this point, you know? So
I know we talked a little bit about Henry Winkler, but his work this season is off the hook, man. He's so, so good, and just the perfect actor for this part. And you know, Devendra brought up that scene where he's shooting his master class.
Yeah,
I mean, it's it's incredible. Like him doing those snippets of, you know, Hamlet, Streetcar, you know, like it's so bad. And yet he buys into it so perfectly and beautifully. And then what the show does with little side characters, you know, we talked about the mother and son and how perfect and beautiful and poetic their little interaction with, like, we know so much about them. That director woman where we get a little moment with her she's having this nervous breakdown. She hasn't done this forever. It's so real and beautiful and something
she says she has no idea what she's doing.
Yes.
And then the assistant is like, we got you. Like we're gonna figure this out.
And what's your name? You know, and the assistant's like, oh shit. You know, you have that thing that we've seen in a million shows and a million movies where, you know, Gene Cousineau has this, you know, this coming to Jesus moment, and he realizes, oh, I'm going to do something good, and I'm going to give this woman another chance. And in every lesser show or movie, she would take that chance, and oh, we feel good because she got this chance. No, this show again subverts expectation. She hasn't done this in a long time. Of course, you would have that moment of feeling like, oh my God, what am I doing here? I haven't done this in 20 years. Like. It thinks through things. Mm-hmm, it subverts expectation. It feels authentic. You relate to it. And it's just this tiny little character that isn't even part of the main story.
It's just, it's wild. And little things too, like stylistic things. I love the scene where he approaches her to like do this is in her, like her art studio, right? And it's shot through the mirror. And I think Bill Hader had mentioned like he saw that in Cold War.
Cold War.
It was I just want it in my show. Okay.
There's actually tons of shots he quote unquote ripped off, paid homage to from like other great films.
But I love it. And like that's the film geek I want to see.
Yes, working. Totally. Yeah. And this is a great PSA to watch Cold War on Prime Video if you haven't.
Watch Cold War. But also, fellow film nerds listening to this, maybe you too can one day make a show like Barry filled with all your favorite references.
Well, indeed. One of my favorite tweets that I saw recently, I can't remember who it was, I would credit them, but it was, it said, Barry season 3 is proof that we should just let Bill Hader do whatever he wants to do for all times. I want that guy to make a film. I want to make whatever he needs to do. I now have become a huge Bill Hader as director, as creator. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always thought he was funny and talented, but like, give this guy lots of money and let him do whatever he wants to do.
Yep.
And Alec Berg too, you know?
Yep.
All right. That's our conversation about Barry season 3. Great season, great show, great finale, really deeply upsetting finale, but really well made. So, and it was great to hear you talk about it, Jeff and Devendra both.
So it's just a bummer that you hate the show, Dave.
Yeah, why?
I mean, it's no...
It's the Now You See Me.
I was going to say, it's no Now You Can See Me.
Do you guys see?
Think I said pay the pauper when I meant pay the piper.
Yes.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry, Dave.
On that note, Jeff, we got a comment on the Patreon that I think in the last episode you mixed up Cretaceous with Crustaceous. Is that possible?
It's certainly possible.
Sure.
Cretaceous. Yeah. Yeah. You know.
Uh huh.
I say things.
Luckily it's not recorded for posterity.
Did you, Jeff, I think my wife might've DM'd this to you, photo of me as a young child, that she posted online recently.
She posted it in the Slack too. You've not seen people's, captioning of it in the Slack, it is top-notch gold material in this.
Yeah, so she found a photo. She was digging through the archives, and she found a photo of me as like a 2-year-old or whatever. And she said, "Let's do a caption contest." And she posted it on Twitter. And my favorite response was somebody who said, the photo, I should describe it, is like a photo of me as a child holding a corded phone, right? And it's like a little baby,
like
David Chen.
4, 3, something like that.
Yeah, very, very young. I think it was less than age 2, actually.
Really?
Around age 2. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Big kid.
I was a big kid, Jeff. Okay. I was a big boy. Okay. And I cannot find the actual person who said this, but the tweet that was my favorite caption of this was, get this. It's a bunch of magicians, but they do heists during the show. Which I just was like, that is incredible. Anyway. So
from the start, a fan from the start.
It's yeah. part get of this. It's part of this internet conspiracy to convince the internet that I liked Now You See Me, one of my least favorite franchises of all time. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Have a good week, everyone. We'll be back next year with Lightyear, and we'll probably do a mailbag episode on the After Dark next week.
So next year. I'm not the next only year, one that makes
next
mistakes.
Week, whatever. What is time? Yeah.
We'll be back in five business days. Uh-huh. No, three, whatever. Fuck it. Lightyear's the next episode.
To infinity.
And beyond.